we're saying, okay, Mr. Property Owner, you are not maintaining this property in a safe manner.
Yeah, that could be from a tenant. It could be from an actual property owner themselves. It could be from adjacent property. Any concern that is submitted to the city would be looked into.
Okay, so I mean, you could look over your back fence and say, hey, my neighbor's porch is about to collapse and their kids are playing under it all every day. Something like that.
That's a really good question, Mayor. So from our perspective, we would investigate a complaint like that from the property at which the complainant requested us to, but we would not be able to pursue it too much without actually being able to see the issue from the public right away, unless we went and approached that property owner and asked permission to enter into their property.
Thank you. Any other question?
So then the discretion would be, you know, if you're going somewhere to investigate a complaint or you can see it, there would be the possibility to go, we're not going to worry about this and walk away. Or are we going to be, we see something, we do it. So where does the judgment come into? I mean, am I the only one that heard that when we were explaining it, where there's a little bit more judgment, we're able to exercise a little bit more judgment. I don't know if judgment was the right word, but discretion maybe was the word.
I'm not recalling that at this time. Do you remember the slide at which was referenced?
Yeah, it was the slide that the word maintenance was on the top of it.
Oh, there you go. Go back, Phil, to the direction.
Yep. Back up one.
There.
Yeah. Property maintenance code, unsafe conditions, provides clarity for the building official to determine unsafe conditions. Does that mean we're going to be more by the book, or was that more of a general judgment call? Grace, like giving a little bit more grace to the building official.
That was just a short synopsis of what the California Health and Safety Code considers as unsafe conditions. So instead of just providing the whole list of them, I just use that as a quick reference. So it'd be consistent with the California Health and Safety Code, which would be consistent with, generally speaking, things that are fire life safety related. Yeah. Yes, but I would still have the discretion. That's correct.
Okay. Any other questions from council?
Yeah, just to comment on the one you had up there, the municipal code. I wanted to thank you, Mr. St. John, for recommending that to be in the municipal code. Even though it might be redundant locations, but this is going to be really helpful for a lot of people looking this stuff up, including myself, when I have to go look for something. This will be great. So I think it's going to be a great addition for a reference. Thank you.
Okay, with that, I'm sure you have another question.
A couple of things. Once I want to second Councilmember Darris's note that to the extent to which this was discretionary of staff to do all this work to bring it in together. Yes, thank you. Anything we can do to make it easier for people to get it right the first time and know what's expected of them. We just heard from a property owner tonight how frustrating it is when the rules seem to be changing and they don't know why and they don't know what's expected. And those frustrations mount really quickly. So hopefully this will be that good and reflect things that staff has noticed. Along those lines, could you just mention briefly, what are the most common things that people think I just want to do this and don't think it requires a permit, but it actually does?
Absolutely. Detached accessory structures to a unlimited size or additions to their single family residence to house water heater closets, exterior laundry rooms, those are probably some of the most common.
Okay, thank you. Just good to educate folks. And then last, in the items that you've presented, and differentiating between what you presented and the discretionary items that Mr. Vansone presented, is any of this discretionary for the council? I mean, we basically, when the state adopts new building codes, they go into effect and we either put them into our code and make it easier for people or we're bound by them anyway, right? Is there any discretion here?
A lot of the items that were added or introduced to be approved for the Atascadero Municipal Code would be at your discretion for approval. So they are additions to, they're not applying provisions of the code to certain areas, but just more or less providing additional clarity. There is one provision that was introduced into the municipal code that actually allows the foundation sizes for structures previously adopted. It was any structure under 1,000 square feet or less could provide a letter of site suitability in lieu of a soils report. And so what we did is we took that and actually applied it to three different sizes of structure. So somebody trying to build a 250 square foot detached accessory storage shed doesn't have the same requirement that somebody is trying to build a 1,000 square foot massive metal steel structure. Yeah, so there'd be money that can be saved on the construction costs and for the licensed design professional or engineering or soils reports.
Okay, so the things in here that make things more efficient, that help people save money, and that pull in stuff that's already in these state and international codes that people are bound by anyway, to get them all in one place so that people can comply better. That's essentially the summary of what we're doing here?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Councilmember Newsom, any questions?
Since we're making it, clarifying this for the public, if you look at the list of ignition resistance and it talks about the materials, where do they get that information that says under floor and eave protection must use the enclosed materials? Do we have a list here at the city that we can provide of what all of that is if they want to?
Council member, do you mind providing the page number, which you're?
Page 24. A major focus of the ignition resistance. You know, it's back in part A, part B. I think we've all blended it together.
Right. Yeah, that's been on ordinance A, but okay.
Especially because we're incorporating these changes into the building code. So it talks about underfloor and eave protection, ignition resistant materials. Where do we get those lists?
I'm going to start with the response and then I'll allow Dave Van Zandt to take it over. But those are the different code sections that are listed primarily in the California Building Code, California Residential Code, but now combined in the California Wildland Urban Interface.
Okay, so if we're trying to be a little bit more proactive as homeowners and we want to implement these without making changes, but we also want a reference as we go to make changes, what's an easy, instead of all of these books over here, what's an easy material that we can provide? Do we have this on our website?
So actually in the code, it specifically sets what I presented tonight is just a synopsis of what it is. But in the code under underside projections, it lists 1 through 8 different types of materials that can be used. But we are putting together a handout for WUI compliance that will be available for contractors and homeowners to tell them what type of material or what needs to be done under those recommendations.
Perfect. And then it makes it a little bit easier. We don't have to figure out what page and what part we're looking at. And then Mr. Bow spoke about turnarounds. Sorry, things gets really loud. Turnarounds, that's for new builds. That isn't something that has to be done for existing flag lots that he was speaking about, correct?
That's correct. And we take it on a case-by-case basis with auxiliary dwelling units as well, depending on the square footage and how far the actual flag lot is, if we would require them to modify or adjust their driveway.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, with that, we will go out to your quick follow-up. Okay,
on this list of things that was mentioned about permits and what people are getting, what you need a permit for, there's a lot of things that people do that they don't realize. Now if you're adding an addition to your house, you should know that. Okay, but right, people will do, it's just a bedroom, so I'm just going to add, it's only a couple hundred square feet, they should know better than that. But there are some things that people, you know, if they're replacing their windows, I got single pane windows and I want to put dual pane in there, I'll just take them out, put new ones in there, I'm doing a good thing. But they don't realize they need a permit. A re-roof. You mentioned the water water heater. A lot of, you know, I've heard a lot of stories, people putting up pergolas over their patio. It's just a pergola. It says, you know, I'm still going to get wet in the rain. So it doesn't have an actual roof on it, so I shouldn't need a permit. But that's not true. If something like that was in here, I don't know if it is. It's probably under frequently asked questions. I don't know if it is. But I think if that's not in here, you know, a list of a lot of the basic things that people do without a permit, it would be good to have that list to say, yes, you need a permit for these items if it's not in there.
I think it's still more under kind of how you structure.
Is that something that's in there now, or is it? Right.
So with the amendments made to the municipal code, there is a portion of it that talks about work exempt for the permit. And then I did list all 13 provisions in the code that specify what specifically does not require a permit.
Oh, okay.
And then on in regards to roofs, there is a provision that was added to clarify at what point a re-roof permit would be required based on the amount of square foot in terms of a repair or replace was also included, just for clarity.
Okay. If I'm sorry if I didn't, if I missed it in here, but if somebody was to, you know, replace windows, they need a permit. Is there someplace in there that where there's a, that they would be able to find that? Or to say, you know, if they're going to say, do I need a permit for to replace my windows, would they look in here and find something that say, yes, you do? Or
no, it's the other way around, council member. It says everything that does not require a permit.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, now we're going to go out to see if we have any public comment on this item. Both pieces of this item, I'd say.
Good presentation. I have a couple questions and comments. My understanding, the state of California does allow a tiny home to be up to 500 square feet. And I also understand that a lot of the 400 square feet are towed in on wheels, and that's why they're 400 square feet. And after the fact, now they're doing 100 square feet expansion pop out on them. I actually have seen them built that way now. So I just want to make sure that we're not downregging our regulation to 400 square feet if it is possible for 500 square feet. The other comment that I have in the general process here is, the gentleman over here has been trying to get his permit for 3 years, and we're adding more fees and more regulations on that. So going back to January 1st retro doesn't make sense to me. It should be a time frame that's reasonable for anybody else applying for new permits or whatever would have to meet all the new codes that are by our city, not by state. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any other public comment on this item? Okay, we'll bring it back to council. I do want to ask that question, though. The tiny house is different than, I mean, we have ADUs. You know, the state has rules like under 750, you don't charge fees, et cetera. We're talking about a minimum, or we're talking about the minimum size of a tiny house is 300, but we say this particular appendix is applicable to SFRs that are less than 400. Is there a tiny home definition minimum somewhere? Or are we saying it's 400 and above, that's not tiny?
I can provide that for you here momentarily, but the reference, typically speaking, to a home is a home. Tiny home is just applying certain provisions of the code to minimize how much square footage is required per occupant. So you could build a 600 square foot tiny home, technically speaking, but it would be, but it's also a 600 square foot could also be a home. But I'll provide the definition here.
Okay, yeah, because I mean, it says this particular appendix applies to single-family residences that are less than 400, but then says a minimum is 300. So, okay, we'll let you pull out the big binder. I want to bring it back to council then and see if we have discussion on where we want to go here. We, you know, the going back to staff recommendation is that we adopt both draft ordinance A and draft ordinance B. Now, both of these repeal and replace in their entirety. In the one case, Title IV, and the other case, Title VIII, which did make it a little harder to read because we couldn't just read changes, you know, like red marked up changes like we do sometimes. But I'll open it for discussion and or motion from council.
I'll make a motion that we approve the recommendations as stated, 1 and 2.
Okay, got it. You mean to adopt draft A, ordinance A and B as
Correct.
Got it. Okay. Do we have a second of that motion, and we'll discuss? Okay, so we have a motion by Mayor Pro Tem Darras, a second by Councilmember Funk. Before we vote, I want to open it up to discussion. Any discussion?
I think that the 50%, I'm still going back and forth with like the determination there. I think the smaller the house, the more that's going to be a burden on the homeowner that's remodeling. You know, I don't know if there's a way to, you know, the larger the footprint of the house, the less likely you're going to be doing 50% or more addition or remodel to the home. But I liken it back to, you know, my first two houses were 1,000 square feet, and 500 square feet is not that big of an addition in the grand scheme of things. And so I just think that there's got to be some sort of break or so I'm just kind of wanted to see if anybody wants to discuss something like that, if there's any sort of leniency on the council for making that less strict.
I understand where you're going. I would like to ask staff then as to in terms of how would you either word or frame that in the sense, would you say that, you know, below a certain size, you know, you can have a sliding scale or whatever, because it's kind of, I understand conceptually where you're going with that, but how do you do that? And the other thing would be, you know, are there different categories as we go with these square footage levels in terms of the way this is written at 300 or 400 or 750 or whatever, where they enter into a different category in terms of what's applicable anyway?
That's a really good question. It would be probably project specific. For example, somebody can do addition but not modify a lot of the stuff on the interior of the structure, or they can do an addition that would be considered a garage. There's just a wide variety of applicability in how we would apply the codes. So the 50% was to kind of go off of that 75% cost evaluations, what would consider a new home, but it would be very specific to each particular project. Dave, I don't know if Mr. Van Sun, if you'd like to add on to that.
Yeah. We were just looking at similarities within the municipal code on our sprinkler ordinance. That's where the 50% came with that. And I don't know, like Mayor stated, I don't know how we would do that on a rolling scale based on different square footage of the home. So it was clear and easy to understand and easy to enforce the code at the 50%. Rather than a rolling scale.
Yeah. I understand. Thank you, Councilmember.
Yeah, couldn't you just do something that it's, you know, the requirement is the greater of 800 square feet or 50% of the addition of the home? If it exceeds that amount, instead of the current one is just 50%, if it exceeds 50%, and all you have to do is say if it exceeds the greater of 800 square feet. I'm throwing that out there.
I think that you're also only looking at an addition, right? Because there's two parts. Addition. There's an addition and the valuation for someone who's, so we're not just talking an addition. I mean, there's two parts to the code. So the 50% is for an addition, but there's also if someone's doing rehab to the house, right? Because then that's where the 75% trigger comes in.
It's only talking about the
addition. So we only care about the addition.
Yeah.
We're okay with just 75%.
The addition and trying to make that for starting square feet that are small may just have a hurdle to apply that. And it's clear in the language that was shown on the screen that the 50% criteria is specific to additions, mm-hmm. and the valuation criteria is specific to updates and other renovations.
Alterations.
I just wanted, I had heard Councilmember Peak mention earlier that he was concerned about both. So I wanted to make sure.
I was concerned about both, but the more I think about it, it's going to be more tough to meet 75%. If you're just altering, like consider my the house I'm in now, I just did the whole inside remodel. I didn't expand the footprint. I just completely did everything inside. It was nowhere near 75% of the replacement value of the house. But then if you do a remodel or an addition on the home, not a remodel, if you do an addition on a home and you're like me and I could live in a box and have a 5-car garage, would that be included? That's more than 50%. It just seems like I'm having the roof, like the grade A roof is fine. You know, like there's certain things that I'm like totally on board with, but replacing a roof on a 1500 square foot house is like $15,000 to $20,000. But then you trigger, okay, now I got to do all the siding on my house to hardy board or stucco. If it's stucco, it's lath and plaster, you're in the $30,000 to $35,000 range. Then maybe you got to paint. If you do hardy board, it's $20,000. You got to paint it for $10,000, and just you just become like this like monster of making the whole outside of your house fireproof, and it could easily be a $50,000 to $70,000 addition to your master ensuite add-on that's already $200,000, right? So it just makes me very nervous to just add all these extra costs. And I understand the fire safety. It's just a matter of, it's just going to encourage people not to improve their properties, which doesn't improve the assessment value of their property, which just, I don't know.
I think there's a point at which though, you know, you got to draw a line somewhere, and the only potential modification I would see would be something along the lines of what Council Member Funk suggested, but that'd be on a smaller home. You apply a minimum square footage or maximum square footage. In other words, if you're doing over 50% or more than 500 square feet or whatever, whichever is greater, you know, so that if you have a 800 square foot home, you know, we allow you to do more than 50%, let's say, slightly more, but a fairly small number. Cause modifying a 1,000 square foot home or, you know, 800 square foot home by another 500 square feet is a pretty significant change in the structure. So in that sense, I feel okay with the percentage because while granted, it's only might be one room or something, it's a pretty significant change. Because, I mean, our first house in town was 900 square feet, you know, wood siding, built in 1930, probably a fire trap, you know. But, you know, adding 500 square feet would have changed the entire, you know, sense of that home. So, I mean, I'm comfortable with 50%, but if you are insistent, I would suggest something along the lines of you allow them to do a certain square footage or 50%, which, you know, whichever is greater would be the triggering point for the new requirements. So.
I don't know. I'd be willing to amend that if as a seconder to that effect. And we can revisit this after we've had this code for a bit, and have staff can come back and let us know, hey, as we work with this, you know, you've got this kind of thing that gets, you know, what falls into this little trap that doesn't make sense to you to require this, but actually technically does. If we find that projects that are, you know, falling into that, then it should come back to council so that we can all move down the learning curve with how to do this. You know, as we're trying to balance, how do we keep our community safe and how do we make it affordable for people to live here?
I think I would just point out that a big reason why I think this discussion was brought up between fire and building was one, to make it a consistent application across the board for these types of builds. And then two, from what they have seen and learned from the most recent fires that occurred in LA and where those fires were occurring, those homes were not in the high and very high, right? So the ember cast and those homes that were burning were in moderate or regular build. And so those were the homes that were then burning to the ground. So I think what fire was looking at was, we're already applying this in our codes for other areas. Why not look at applying it in these moderate areas as well when we're talking about large-scale additions or renovations to homes that then harden the home, that then protect the community at large and the neighborhoods, where then an ember cast. So if you have a 1,000-square-foot house and you've now added a 500-square-foot addition, then the entire home now has that protection, which then doesn't allow ember casting to the next. Because if, like Fire Marshal Van Sun mentioned, if that ember cast comes, it doesn't matter that your 500 square foot house has that section has been hardened, your entire house is going to burn. So that's what they were trying to just sort of put something in that's consistent and that shows learning from other fires. So if we'd like to kind of wait on that and see how many applications we're getting in over the next couple of years in homes within those moderate, and then readdress it at that point, that's what we can do. But I think I just wanted to sort of point out what the logic behind was that. It wasn't to increase cost, it was to protect the community at large.
Mayor, can I add one more?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
That my department, my building official also tells me that in almost all cases, if someone doing a massive addition to their house, more than 50% of the floor area, they almost always replace their entire exterior siding, trim, and roof at the same time to match what they're doing. So it's just something to keep in mind. It's very rare that someone do an addition with that percentage and keep an old portion of the house. It could happen, but it's very rare.
I understand. I mean, I'm hesitant to you know, pause on this and say, you know, bring it back. I, on the other hand, you know, whatever we impose, that is the requirement on applicants until we do otherwise. But I'd like to, we have a motion and a second, and I know you were willing to modify, but, you know, I'd like to call the question and have us vote on the thing as is, and our concerns are noted, and like you to staff to keep that in mind as you see the process going forward. So,
yes, I'd just like to say thank you, Ms. Christensen, for the clarification on that, and I would rather not amend my motion.
Okay.
I'm fine. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and call the question and ask for a roll call on the motion as is.
Councilmember Funk?
Yes.
Councilmember Newsom?
Yes.
Councilmember Peak?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Daris?
Yes.
Mayor Bourbeau?
Yes.
Motion passes unanimously.
Okay. Thank you. That was a long item, H2. Our next item is item I1, but I think we need to take a very short break since we've gone on longer than I thought. And so let's make it 8 minutes. We'll be back at 8:35.
Tonight's Atascadero City Council meeting is in recess and will resume in just a short time. Thanks for listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL.
Manned missions into space tread a perilous line between mastery and misfortune. And the Apollo 13 mission had plenty of both.
T-minus 25 seconds and counting, and Apollo 13 is go.
It began on April 11th, 1970, as the third trip to the moon in less than a year. And its launch was accompanied by all the confidence and expectations of success that the two previous missions had engendered.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
But as the crew circled the moon and prepared for a landing on the lunar surface 2 days later, events went terribly wrong. An oxygen tank blew up and another failed. The command module's supply of electricity, light, and water was lost, along with two of the spacecraft's three fuel cells. Suddenly, 200,000 miles from home, the Apollo 13 crew was in mortal danger.
Cities of the world woke up today to potential tragedy in outer space. NASA spokesman Glenn Lunny did his best to explain at today's Houston news conference.
At about 55 hours and 54 minutes, tank 2, cryogenic oxygen, was fine. Within less than 1 minute, the pressure in that tank had gone to zero. At the same time, fuel cell 3 went down and the main bus B went down. Of all the times on the way out to the moon, this is probably the most difficult time for a problem like this to occur. Quickly, it became clear to us after we had time to review it that the course of action was to retain the lunar module and to swing on around the moon and to prepare to do a maneuver which would, in effect, shorten the return time back to the Earth.
Now, a real-life televised drama took place as the ground controllers in Houston improvised procedures to bring the crew home safely. The astronauts ate sparingly to save water, traveled in near-freezing cold without sleep to save energy, and manually guided their craft into position to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere without burning up. After a few heart-stopping minutes during re-entry, when communication was interrupted and the fate of the astronauts unknown, Apollo 13 miraculously glided to the most accurate landing in the history of the Apollo flight program.
Recovery, I have astronaut Hayes aboard. His condition is excellent.
Astronauts James Lovell, Fred Hayes, and John Swigert emerged from their capsule alive and well. Apollo 13 was officially classified as a successful failure, a mission which had failed to attain its original objective. But the real story of that journey, which would eventually be made into an Academy Award-winning motion picture, is the triumph of human ingenuity and heroism under fire.
Tonight's Atascadero City Council meeting is in recess and will resume in just a short time. Thanks for listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL.
Welcome to Heroes of the Air, true stories of those who flew for America and earned the nation's supreme military award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Heroes of the Air is brought to you by the Air Force Association, an independent nonprofit aerospace organization which promotes public understanding of the role aerospace power plays in our national defense. Your host for Heroes of the Air is Gene Pell.
U.S. Air Force Major George Andrew Davis, Jr. was leading a flight of four F-86 Sabre jets on a combat aerial patrol mission when his element leader ran out of oxygen and was forced to retire from the flight with his wingman accompanying him. Near the Manchurian border, over the Yalu River, February 10, 1950. Major Davis was CO of the 334th Fighter Squadron, 4th Fighter Group, 5th Air Force. As he continued the mission with the remaining F-86, he sighted a formation of approximately 12 enemy MiG-15s speeding southward toward an area where friendly fighter bombers were conducting low-level operations. With selfless disregard for the numerical superiority of the enemy, Major Davis positioned his two aircraft and dove toward the MiG formation. While speeding through the formation from the rear, he singled out a MiG-15 and destroyed it with a concentrated burst of fire. Although he was now under continuous attack from the MiGs at his rear, Major Davis sent another enemy plane into a vertical dive, bursting into smoke and flames, and as he sought out a third enemy fighter, Major Davis sustained a direct hit, went out of control, and crashed into a mountainside. But his bold attack had completely disrupted the enemy formation, permitting the friendly bombers to successfully complete their mission. For his indomitable fighting spirit, heroic aggressiveness, and superb courage in engaging the enemy against formidable odds, Air Force Major George Andrew Davis, Jr. was posthumously awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor.
The Air Force Association is proud to bring you Heroes of the Air, dedicated to those who earned the nation's highest military award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Their service and sacrifice reflect an ideal that puts others and country above self. AFA salutes all men and women in the Air Force who so selflessly serve our country each day at home and around the globe. Heroes of the Air is produced by Pelcom Communications in association with Radio America.
Tonight's Atascadero City Council meeting is in recess and will resume in just a short time. Thanks for listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL.
Are howling way out where the dog is bawling, where spurs are a jingling, a cowboy is singing this lonesome cattle call. Rounds up the cattle each fall. Singing his cattle call. And he sings with an old western drawl. Ooh, singing his cattle call.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Council. All right. Well, I'm going to basically start tonight off by saying this is kind of the beginning of a little bit of a marathon. About the general plan over the last few months. You're going to hear a lot more about the zoning and the general plan over the coming months as we get into the home stretch of adopting both of these very substantial documents. Tonight, we're going to kind of introduce the first of several sections of the zoning. The zoning has so much to it, we want to break it up in individual pieces. We're not going to be asking you for an action tonight, but we do want to introduce some basic things and kind of outline what's to come in the future. But we're also kind of going to get through some descriptions of some components of sort of the basic outline of how the new zoning code format is going to go and some of the things that we're going to be doing in terms of process and entitlement improvements. Now, we're very fortunate tonight. We have our consultant with MIG, Genevieve, who's going to be online kind of giving you some of the details. We'll get to that in a little bit. But let's take a look kind of where we are right now. It's February 10th, and we're really what we're in study session one of the zoning. We're going to come back to you on March 10th with another study session on zoning. We'll talk about another module such as mixed use, and then again March 24th, then again on April 14th. Now, sprinkled in throughout this time is also going to be some discussion on the general plan. Basically, it gets us to final adoption and certification of the EIR by June. So it's a fairly aggressive schedule. We're finally in that home stretch. As you know, over the last year, we've been working in the background on the environmental impact report, on the final sections of the general plan, and on this draft zoning to get us to the point where we're at today. So I think at this point, are we going to turn it over to Genevieve, our consultant? And I think if we do a little technology, we can get her online. Here she is. She's been waiting hours to speak with us. Thank you, Genevieve.
Great. Thank you so much. And I'm excited to be here tonight. I actually cannot see the slide that we are on in the view that I have. So I might need a little bit of assistance in that, but I assume you're on the slide that says objectives and outcomes. And we can go to the next slide, which should have three numbers on it. Oh, yes. Now I can see it. That's better. Thank you. So we've identified, and good evening, Mayor, Council, and staff. Thanks for having me tonight. We've identified three kind of main objectives for the zoning code part of the project. And the first is really linked to the general plan. As we're doing the general plan has these new, as you know, place types and new policies. The zoning code is a direct implementation measure of the general plan. So we want to achieve consistency with all of the new policies and place types that you're developing. Second, we really want to make the code easier to use. That key to that is reformatting it and using really clear language, everyday language that anyone can understand. And third, we want to build on the work that has been done over the last few years to really try and streamline the entitlement process. Next slide. So the zoning code, as I said, is a really, it's directly implemented, and directly linked to the general plan, and it's a direct implementation action of that new general plan. The zoning code goes into a lot more detail. The general plan, you know, is inherently more general. The zoning code sets up the structure, though, for how projects can get built, both from listing the development standards and the process that goes into when an applicant comes in and is seeking an entitlement. So if a discretionary permit's not required, the zoning code also lists those development standards that have to be followed in order to get that ministerial building permit approval. Next slide. So as you're all aware, the general plan has these new land use place types, and the zoning code takes those place types and translates those into zoning districts. Multiple zoning districts might exist within a single general plan place type, as you see here in the rural residential and single family residential place types. The new general plan will also include two separate mixed use place types, which then translate into six different mixed use zoning districts. And we'll discuss that, as Phil mentioned, in more detail in the next study session we see in March. The new commercial and industrial place types will also correlate with unique zoning districts, as will the agriculture, public, and conservation place types. So the result of this is a zoning map that directly implements the general plan place types. The second objective is really to increase transparency and predictability for anyone who uses the zoning code. The most probably visible aspect of this effort will be a complete reorganization of the code to make it more intuitive so we can find things more easily in the code, but also with a focus on brevity and ease in understanding. And then our third objective is really building on that good streamlining work the city has already started with projects that were adopted in 2024 for objective design standards and CEQA thresholds for certain environmental conditions. This project is really trying to build on those successes and incorporate consistent timelines and align processes for various entitlements. So one of the most important parts of zoning code update, even if it's really boring, is reorganizing the code into a structure that makes sense. So the existing code has not been comprehensively updated since it was adopted back in 1983. And as time went on, new chapters had to be added as state laws changed and circumstance changed, and they didn't always have a logical place to go. There just wasn't space left in the existing code. So new chapters were added kind of at the end to respond to changes over time. This project will reorganize chapters to allow for more logical placement now. So we're going to put those in the right place, but also allow for amendments over time to kind of slot into the right locations. So the proposed zoning format is in these kind of eight chapters. And as amendments come, they can slide in to these placements. One of the key aspects of that will be adding kind of an additional level in the organizational structure called the article level. So there's eight chapters proposed in the zoning code. And then there's this article level that some chapters in the municipal code use really well and some of them don't. And we're going to embrace the article because having that extra layer of kind of hierarchy really helps with organization. A lot of the times in the code right now, that article might be used, but we don't have a separate number that then you can put everything under that number so that you're not running out of numbers moving forward. So this is going to allow for amendments to be located in the right place from a numbering perspective. So it'll be a great improvement. So chapters 6 and 7 in the new zoning code are going to cover processes and entitlement procedures. So we want to go over these couple of chapters with you tonight. They are pretty minor changes that are proposed in these chapters. In general, administrative procedures can be kind of vague or confusing and really just kind of affect development. They're frustrating for users, they're frustrating for staff. So the new zoning code is really being written with the goal of implementing really clear and predictable procedures that avoid confusion for both applicants and staff and then result in predictable outcomes. So in recent years, the city's adopted a variety of changes to procedures, some to implement new state law requirements like SB 9 and density bonus and ADU law, as well as the Housing Accountability Act. And then the city's also proactively updated procedures like the CEQA thresholds for hillsides, historical areas near creeks, to have a really clear process for development for those projects. So the new Chapter 6 builds on that good existing work and it organizes all of the entitlements and processing procedures into one place. So we're also leaving space in our new numbering system for amendments to integrate within the existing structure rather than leaving everything to tack on at the end. So we use an even numbering system so you can slot things in over time. The proposed changes to processes and procedures chapter, they're really fairly minor, even though there's a lot of words on this slide, but they generally formalize existing processes that are already kind of department policies. We just really want to clearly outline them in the zoning code to make it clear what's expected of applicants. So for instance, the current fee schedule has a number of items that aren't mentioned in the zoning code. So this draft proposes to better align the fee schedule with sections in the zoning code so that people know what they're being charged for and what the requirements are for those particular things. So for instance, we've got two new sections one is for ministerial review of business licenses, which will be called a zoning clearance, and the other is for a review of building permits to ensure compliance with zoning regulations. The current code also doesn't list the process that an applicant has to go through for certain entitlements and certain permits. So alcohol licenses are not referenced. While we have standards for plan developments and specific plans and general plan amendments and development agreements, we don't actually list the process right now in the code. So we want to be clear, like, what is the process that someone has to go through to go to make that application happen? So the new code will articulate what that process is, and that's consistent with what the city's already been doing. It's just making it really clear for everyone. Similarly, with temporary use permits, currently temporary events are covered largely by department policies. So adding this into the entitlements and process section of the zoning code really just helps provide clear direction for applicants on the required process and any required performance standards. One other change to note, currently a native tree permit for a heritage tree goes directly to City Council. Because the Planning Commission is a recommending body for City Council, and we've kind of listed that really clearly in the zoning code, we want to be consistent with all of the permits that do that same process. So we would recommend that the native tree permit for a heritage tree, instead of skipping straight to City Council, makes a stop at Planning Commission for their recommendation before getting to City Council. So the new entitlement processes chapter is going to include tables to really clearly articulate who is the responsible review authority for these various actions. With regard to legislative actions, the process is going to be outlined to show that the community development director is responsible for review of these pieces, with the exception of development agreements, which are reviewed by the city manager's office. And then the Planning Commission recommends, and the City Council will act to approve or deny the action. So these are all processes that are currently undertaken. We're just consolidating them in one place, making them really clear, but no change to review authority or process are proposed. For other entitlements that don't require City Council approval, the new tables will clearly outline who is the review authority, with the Community Development Director responsible for acting on precise plans, administrative use permits, and temporary use permits, and the Planning Commission acting on variances, conditional use permits. This is the same as current process today. No changes are proposed. The table continues with other various entitlements that are acted on largely by the Community Development Director, generally ministerial actions, with the exception of native tree permit reviews, and there's no change proposed to the non-heritage tree permits, just that one that I mentioned with regard to the heritage trees making a stop at Planning Commission before Council. With regard to design review, we'd like to be more clear about what the process is at various levels and, again, align directly with the fee schedule for the different types of review. So we want to use the same terminology in the code and in the fee schedule, so and kind of how people generally refer to these entitlements to eliminate confusion for applicants. There's no real changes to the overarching process that are proposed. The same projects that go to DRC today would go to DRC in the future. But for instance, the master plan of development isn't really talked about in the zoning code, but we've got it in the fee structure. So we want to codify that existing practice. One minor change would be to make the process for what we've termed the design review modifications. So these are kind of a deviation from the general code standards. And to date, we have a lot of these scattered throughout the code, and they're largely approved with an administrative use permit process. But it's not really a use-related approval. It's about allowing a slightly different development standard. For example, one example in the code now is that in single-family dwellings, you can ask for an additional 5 feet in height with approval of an administrative use permit. But the findings for an administrative use permit don't really make sense for that kind of an approval. So we'd like to create this process that links deviations from development standards with the appropriate findings through this other process. So it's really kind of a parallel approval process, doing the same kind of thing, just with the right findings associated with them. This also allows for an avenue for design review modifications to deviate from objective design standards that were adopted in 2024. With regard to Chapter 7, this one covers the administrative procedures that apply across the board. This is appeals, noticing, hearings, and entitlement procedures after they've been approved. In general, the processes and procedures remain the same as existing code describes. Key changes are really identified to be more efficient and to formalize some existing policies. Specifically, from an efficiency standpoint, we propose to make a minor change to hearings that the Community Development Director oversees. So this is currently AUPs and precise plans, and it would include that design review modifications that would go to the director as well. So currently the director, if a project comes for one of these, the director would notice the project, and the notice includes a hearing date and time, and then the director holds that hearing and makes the action. But often no one shows up for that hearing, as you know, they can either they support the project or they can call staff ahead of time, get their questions answered, and feel no need to come to the hearing. So because they're not hugely attended, and to be more efficient, we propose to notice the project and in that notice say you can request a hearing, and if you would request the hearing, we'll hold the hearing. Otherwise, we won't hold the hearing. So just to save time, money, not hold unnecessary hearings, that's the proposal that we recommend there. There's also some larger projects where staff has found that kind of a larger than standard 300 foot radius is important and warranted. So particularly for general plan amendments, zoning map amendments, where the use of the property is really potentially going to change. So the new code proposes to codify that larger radius for mailing notices when this type of project is proposed, really looking to make greater transparency for the surrounding neighborhood. And also, we just want to note in the new code that the director could make a larger than standard noticing radius at any time to, you know, if it's a important issue, we just want to codify that the director could do that in the interest in the community. A few final changes to note. The current code has an existing entitlement expiration for DRC approvals that's only 1 year, but everything else is 2 years. We want to make sure everything's consistent. All entitlements should expire after 2 years so that nothing is confusing. It's much easier to enforce and less confusing for applicants. And then finally, if an applicant wants to amend an existing entitlement currently, if it's really minor, it's done at the director level as a finding of consistency. We want to codify that practice, which is currently a department policy. And then major amendments certainly go back to the original entitlement application procedure, going back to the review authority to review anything major. So tonight, we don't really have any specific options for you to consider because these changes are pretty minor, with the really big item being the total kind of reorganization of the code. Largely, the effort associated with these chapters is about formalizing existing processes and ways we can try and make it a little easier to apply and process entitlements in a Atascadero. So I'm here for any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to start on my left. Councilmember Peak, any questions?
What's a heritage tree?
Excellent question.
And how old does it have to be? And who determines that?
I can answer that, Genevieve. We actually have an established list of heritage trees. And for example, they include the Deodar Cedars in Sunken Gardens Park, the large coast live oaks that line East Mall and West Mall, the sycamores along Atascadero Avenue. I think to name, that's pretty much all of them. There's a few others in town. But basically, heritage trees are trees that were planted at the time of the origin of the city of Atascadero back in the era of E.G. Lewis. And they're trees that have significant prominence in the community, not just really age, but they're
so not prominent. Just like really big oak trees on my property that have been there for 300
no, years. No, there's a very specific list, and okay, they're all within close to downtown.
I'm not cutting them down. I'm just wondering about that.
Yeah.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem Darris.
I'm going to follow up on that one. We're on a roll with follow-ups. So if a heritage tree, which we've had a couple of them now in Sunken Gardens that have died and been taken out, is replaced with another tree, is it still considered a heritage tree?
That question has not ever been asked. It has to have some heritage behind it to become a heritage tree. It takes a long time.
Well, we're replacing one. I would think that, you know, we would want it to live on, but okay. That makes sense. Either way. Question I had, Genevieve, great job. You covered a ton of stuff really quickly. there was a couple of slides that showed where the decision-making was taking place. These here. And there was one in particular that caught my attention, and then I'll ask a question specifically on that one. It had to do with zoning variance changes being done at the Planning Commission level and not City Council. And is any of these changed, or are these all existing the way we're doing them now?
This is the existing process. So no changes are proposed there.
Okay. So all of these that are on these charts on these few slides, they're all currently, nothing's changing on any of these.
Correct. Yes.